Shelley Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelley.
Oh, October is almost over. It appears to be the 28th day of that month, according to that thing we call a calendar, allegedly. Anyways, this is the show you were looking for. Guess how I know that? You found it. Thursday, the second to last broadcast day of the week at O'Shelley.com. But funny thing is, coming in November, that's going to change. An interesting show is going to come up in November, and I'll talk about that when I have more time. I don't want to take away time from tonight's discussion. I have back with me Larry Hancock, David Boylan. Probably just butchered his name again, but I apologize, and maybe I do it as a, what do they call that, a passive-aggressive thing, because everybody screws up my name. Maybe that's why I do that, and David, you're not the only guy I do it to, but extremely happy to have you guys back. Why? We're going to go over, well, the JFK January lead number one, I called it the first time. Now we're going to go over lead number two, and of course, I'm not the only one calling it the lead, but they call it the Redbird lead. I think of it as the January lead, okay? Because every time I've seen this discussed in the past, that's usually where it begins. And oddly, it may begin again there. We're going to hear from our guests in just a couple minutes. But first, Larry Hancock, how are you doing tonight, sir?
I'm doing fine, Chuck. I'm actually doing a lot better than David, who lost power for about a day. So I haven't lost it yet, which is great.
Well, you haven't lost your power. I don't know if you've lost it yet. We'll find out soon.
That's a very good qualitative point. I totally agree.
I'm breaking your chops, Larry. You know that. And you know I love you. That's why I do it. I appreciate you. Trust me. I'm just making jokes. But, you know, David did lose his power. I wasn't going to bring it up. But it might have been questionable if he could have made it today because of Nor'easter, I guess. And I've been in that region and dealt with that before. Gotta say, I'm really, really happy that they got it together in less than a day to get your power back on, or at least less than a day from when I was informed about it. So glad to have you along, David. I'm looking really, really forward to this discussion. How are you tonight, sir?
I am doing fine. I'm doing good. It's good to have power and heat back, you know, so it's great.
Amazing how you almost take that for granted sometimes till, guess what, it ain't there anymore. Right? Anyway, look, again, I'm kind of trying to make jokes, but we are going to cover some serious material. And before that, Larry, you know, you had something that you wanted to remind people about, and I'm going to be reminding people about shortly, but you know, there are still going to be conferences on the Kennedy assassination. Some of them will be virtual, if not all. So that is the world in which we live in. And you might have a little inside information about one of them, just vaguely, you know, because you're not really involved with it or anything. Again, I know these are my jokes, but I'm not a comedian.
Only for 15 or 20 years, shoot.
Yeah, I mean, you know, just a couple times.
Right one of these days.
I mean, one of these days, they're going to let you sit at the adult table over there, right? I mean,
oh, heavens, I hope so.
Larry is deeply involved with the JFK Lancer conferences, the November in Dallas, you know, which I have been proud to participate in a couple of times, once in person, once in virtual form, and you know, I might be part of this one too, guys, and maybe in more than one presentation this year. But Larry, there's a lot better things going on over there than me. What is going to happen? When is it going to happen? Tell us about Lancer this year.
This Lancer will be doing its annual conference. It will be virtual this year, as it was last year. And you know, there's some things that you miss, like the personal contacts and the hallway conversations. But the other thing is, by doing it virtually and by streaming it, you don't have to miss anything. You have two options for the conference. You can sign up at the conference and just listen to the streaming, listen to all the sessions, or for a higher fee, still only $100-some, you can archive the whole thing and listen to it as many times as you want. which is, you know, something you couldn't do with a real conference. So this way, with our virtual conferences, you absolutely have an opportunity to get anything in all the presentations. It will be streamed over the anniversary date in November. Everybody's familiar with that. I think one of the things this year we're happy about, again, is one of the challenges of doing a JFK conference is having something for everyone, because there are very broad interest in this subject. That, you know, people are interested in what's going on now, what went on historically, you know, the context, the backstory for the assassination. There are people that are just coming into this seriously for the first time and want to pick up some history. And so We think we've managed to cover the gamut. I mean, we will have several presentations that deal with from people that were working with the first generation researchers, like Mark Lane, right. You know, people that knew those folks and can give some real background to the people that are just entering the study of the assassination. We've got people that will be giving insights into the current record releases, what's going on in regard to records, what we've gotten in the past years, what we hope to get, what we're not getting, so we can update people on that. Malcolm Blunt will be speaking about something which is brand new, which is the archiving of his documents that he's collected over decades of personal work at NARA. Malcolm is one of the
To interrupt you quickly, look, Malcolm Blunt is the best author on the JFK assassination you didn't realize you already read, because he has contributed to so many other people's work in one way or another, generously, quite frankly, you don't realize you probably, if you've read good material on it, it's a fair bet Malcolm Blunt had something to do with it. There is not enough I can say about Malcolm Blunt. So just him being a presenter alone is interesting enough. But you don't just have authors. You have people that participated in things. You have people that are of interest for their past work, maybe new work. Is somebody going to address the real current situation? And this is going to happen, by the way, on the weekend closest to the assassination date, which is how this works. So you got to look for it on the 19th, I think they said to me. Is that right, Larry?
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's that weekend, beginning on that Friday the 19th and going through till the 21st. Obviously, Monday is the 22nd. Historically, the 22nd and 63 was on a Friday. But either way, it is over the course of that weekend that we're going to see all this. And look, some of the best authors possible have presented at these conferences, some of the best researchers, some real witnesses to the event, or, well, the other events around the event, have presented. And quite frankly, I don't even know everybody who's going to be on this just yet. Stuff is still being prepared and recorded as, well, Larry and I are speaking about it. Is that a fair summation, Larry, or do we need more?
Oh, it's definitely in progress. And I just to reassure people, so we will have everything from the history of the research, contemporary information on what's going on with the record releases, and Larry Schnapp, who's very deeply involved in the legal aspects of that, will be presenting on it, to new research. I mean, we will have authors, but we'll also have researchers, ranging from Mike Chesser speaking on forensics and x-rays, Bill Simpich, myself and David will be presenting, Stu Wexler will be presenting, Gil Jesus, a lot of people that are deep researchers, and even if they have not written, they will be presenting hardcore assassination research. This is like new findings, new information. So we really try to cover the breadth, and we will also have presentations not only on JFK, but also on the RFK and MLK assassinations. So the real point is that there will be something there for everybody. We encourage everyone to take a look at it. I think, Chuck, you have we'll be putting up a link where they can get into the information about the conference. So hopefully everyone will participate.
Right. And the thing about this is, again, people used to go to the conferences and try and buy either the videotapes. Yes, I remember that. Or the DVDs afterwards. There is a way that you can do both simultaneously, as Larry was saying, and end up with just download the video yourself and you'll have it. And that's all there is to it. So anyway, I will be giving out the website and all that. I was just waiting for some work to be done on the website. And we'll definitely talk about this in the next couple of weeks as the event gets closer. But anyway, I want to turn to tonight's stuff before we get too far away, because already 10 minutes. And there is a lot to go over, Larry. A lot here. Why? Like I said, this links to the first lead that we talked about 2 weeks ago. But it goes elsewhere. And in my usual style of disruption, before I even give David a chance to speak, two questions. Okay. I found it interesting, and you're going to lay this out at some point, but I find it interesting the continuous revisitation of somebody like Richard K. Snegel, who, look, I appreciated Dick Russell's work and still do, but quite frankly, there's a character I don't think anybody's ever going to get their full hands around. And there is a lot here where I got to tell you, it's very difficult to follow where we're going to go. And really, it is the fault of individuals who I think have tried to misuse some of the available information in the past. Wait a minute. This sounds familiar. I think I said this last time. David, I think I said this last time. I know I did. And I think that still stands. Now, I've taken a look at this this second lead, and of course I'm looking at a draft of it, so you know, I'm not here to critique language or a structure or anything like that, because I know I'm not looking at a final draft, right? Okay. And besides that, I am not the proverbial grammar Nazi. It's not my thing. But There is some information here which I find it very hard to tie together, and I'm looking forward to how you're going to do this. So, Richard K. Snegel only gets a mention here, by the way. He's not the focus of this at all. But he gets a mention in your writing, and I was just curious what your opinion of exactly how useful the K. Snegel story is in general. Because people have mixed opinions about this, and I would say that the striking premise is at the very least questionable that everybody used for many years to introduce him into the discussions. You know, the idea that he, you know, in short, shot a hole in a bank and then sat down and waited to be arrested, that may or may not be exactly gospel. And there may or may not be a lot of things about the guy's story that are either purposely or by function of just the strangeness of the world the man lived in. Very, very difficult to nail down to a factual narrative. Or maybe I'm just unfair to the entire story. David, what is your thought about that? And then I want to get into... I know he's like, I could talk about this for a half hour, I bet. I don't want that. I just want a general opinion about that, because I can actually see a parallel in the story that you're developing, except one thing is you have a lot more documentary evidence to work with than the story of Richard K. Snegel does, to me. Maybe I'm wrong about that, too. David, like I said, just along those two parallels, I would say that it's one of these things where it's difficult to follow like this. You do mention it, so I know you're well aware of it. I know Larry's well aware of it, but I actually don't want Larry's opinion on this. I want yours. So can you help me out?
All right. I read Dick Russell's book when it first came out, and I thought it was fascinating. I mean, I'm one of those people who actually read the footnotes and the endnotes, and I found it absolutely fascinating. So many characters other than Nigel was introduced there. Mm-hmm. I read all the Nigel's letters to his friend Greenspun when he first wrote them, and they were so cryptic. You know, you can make slight, you know, ideas about exactly what he was trying to say, and you know who the people, you know, like Bravo was supposed to be Alpha 66, things like that, but came away totally confused. Like, all right, I have no idea where he's going. Mm-hmm. And I left saying there was nothing really to hang your hat on. There's no meat to it. Kept right. waiting for more. That's my opinion. I think, does he have a lot to say? He's an interesting guy, but I don't think we'll ever get to the bottom of exactly what he was trying to say and do.
See, now and that's exactly how I feel about this second January lead prior to reading what you guys have put together. Okay, so that's why I'm saying this, is that I'm exactly with you, where you're like, it's interesting. There's something here. I'm not sure exactly how valuable it is. It's a skeletal kind of thing, and you have to use your imagination a little bit, because there's some cryptic elements here. There's some stuff that's obviously kind of missing, because it just has yet to be discovered, for sure. And this, I felt the same way about this, what we're going to talk about now, for a long time, where it's like, this is interesting, but I don't know what to do with it, you see. And it didn't have, for me, enough to hang my hat on, where I say, this is a significant thing that I would have even invested the time in that you guys did to put this together. Okay? Please don't take that as a personal criticism. I'm just saying that I wouldn't have even thought to elaborate on this, because it just didn't seem to have enough for me to sink my teeth in to begin with, to get a taste. Well,
I'm going to blame Larry. It's all Larry's fault for doing this.
Oh, okay. Hey, listen, no, if all else fails, blame Larry. He won't really object that loudly, I don't think. Right, Larry?
Not a problem.
You're like me. You want to blame me? That's fine. Let's move on, right?
Obsessiveness is my thing.
Yep.
Okay, enough with the jokes. Dave, so how would you introduce this? First, you know, most people that are going to hear this are very well aware of the history I'm talking about. But let's try and do this, you know, as you did in the beginning of the second lead there. How is it that you would present this to somebody who says, why does this even matter when it comes to the case? I mean, because that used to be the weird thing for somebody. I mean, I had somebody who was not aware of anything read parts of this to me. And I had to keep explaining a whole bunch of stuff, you know, like where they're like, that's what that means. Yeah, that's what that means. There's a lot here, and unless you're kind of schooled in a whole bunch of background, it's tough. So what would be the layman's explanation for this without going, you know, into the details that you're obviously going to have to go into to explain it?
Well, in January, you know, he worked at Redbird Airport, and had a lot of interactions with people, you know, renting and buying planes. The second lead, which was the one that was actually, I think he had a newspaper article about this in Dallas newspaper in 1964. Mm-hmm. He had a couple, a young man and woman, that drove up in an old car, I think a 1947. He says he recognized, because he had one just like it. They were not well-dressed. Said the man and the woman spoke to him about actually renting a plane, mm-hmm. and having Wayne January actually be the pilot. In the back seat was a young man who remained there, did not speak. And they wanted January to use that pilot for a long flight. They were kind of hinting about Cuba. They said, you know, what about the air? How far can it go? On the fuel it has? What about if the air, the wind is blowing in one certain direction? And he got really, use the word, he got creeped out by it. He goes, all right, I think they're talking about actually me flying this plane and being hijacked to Cuba. So he backed right off and said, I want nothing to do with this. So that's your basic. Larry, am I right about that? Anything you want to add?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's important. January felt that this was serious enough once he after the assassination to report to the FBI. Right. This isn't just an anecdotal story he told to his wife or to kids or relatives or cousins. It was serious enough to him after the assassination, after he recognized the young man who remained in the car as being Lee Oswald or someone who looked exactly like Lee Oswald, to think he had a serious lead pertaining to the assassination of Oswald being in company with other people and something serious going on around Lee Oswald and other people.
Now, another red flag here, though, Larry, could be that, and I need a little context from you just real quick. How difficult would it be for somebody, you know, like, is this even unusual that somebody needs to go ahead and rent a plane privately to go to Cuba? Is there a problem at this point in our history where you can't quite travel there so easily? I mean, you know, I'm serious. I know it sounds like a dumb question, okay? And yeah, I'm setting you up.
lots of problems. First of all, January there were private planes to rent at Redbird. I mean, that wasn't the core of January's business, as we discussed last time. The core of his business was handling aircraft sales, but he was in a position so he could rent aircraft. Yeah, there was a lot wrong with the thought of going to Cuba or making a long-distance flight. I mean, as David said, the first thing that struck him is that these people did not appear to be the type of folks who would have the money to pay for an aircraft rental, especially for an aircraft and a pilot. So that really put him off, because that was, you know, that was an investment. And somebody in an old car who wasn't dressed very well, it's like, where are you going to get the cash? And when they got into all the questions, it's like, where you want to go to the Yucatan? You want to go out in the Caribbean? But as you say, the context is it would have been illegal. There was a, you know, administration ban on travel to Cuba. It was literally illegal to do that. So if they had specifically asked him to go to Cuba, that would have been a neutrality violation, a legal violation. And, of course, he was concerned that they weren't just going to outright say that. They were getting him to prepare the plane for a very long-range flight and actually would hijack him in progress. So, yeah, there were a lot of things that made him nervous about it at the time, and of course then afterwards he much more nervous. But yeah, it was an unusual request in the context of the legality and in the context of the people that were, you know, trying to pitch this rental in the first place.
Right. Okay. No, I just wanted to offer that as something that needed to be there, because, you know, somebody thinking about it now might think nothing of it, you know. So I just want to make sure we had that in there. David, do you think that's fair, right? I mean, we should offer that as part of this before you get further into this story, which is already strange because, well, you know, January thinks you might have seen Lee Harvey Oswald as a third person, and this couple who doesn't look like his usual clientele. There's something odd going on here, and a whole lot of, like, you know, my gut tells me this might be a problem. But at first, it seems as though he was just going to let it go. Like, I'm just going to avoid this. I'm not sure what it is. But when and how did that change?
Him actually avoiding this? I mean, when did it change? After he spoke to them and they were asking all these various questions about
it might have gone by as nothing, right? So when did that change? I mean, is it because he realizes later that this guy might be Lee Harvey Oswald, or is it, you know, sometime later he thinks about it and I'm not sure if I should go to the government about this or not? Is it part of the Warren Commission investigation? When does that actually change for January, according to what we know?
Oh, after the assassination, they had the picture of Oswald in the newspaper. He said, that looks like the guy, resembles him. It's either him, somebody that looks like him, was in the backseat of that car. He remembered it, the details, quite vividly, because, again, a lot of things just raised his hackles. He said, red flags, that something's going on here. Right. You got to remember, way back in those days, if you're old enough, you remember it was a cliche to say, you know, somebody hijack a plane and say, take me to Cuba. I mean, there were a lot of plane hijackings back in those days. Mm-hmm. Airlines was not unusual. And some people in Cuba would, you know, hijack a plane, take me to the United States. And January did report it to the FBI afterwards. And when they actually came to question him, they asked him all about his, you know, Jack Ruby and carousel clubs and contacts. And he realized right away they didn't really want to know what was going on here. Mm. They actually made no effort to investigate, you know, a conspiracy. You know, it's just like, no, this can't be him. Oswald's supposed to be at work. But we did find the day of the incident. This was, I think, the Wednesday before the 22nd. So this would be the 20th. This was, you know, the time of the incident matches the day that Oswald was actually late for work. He'd have breakfast every morning at, was at Dobbs' house, early, like 7:30 before he would go to work. And this time it was around 10:30. He made a quite a bit of ruckus, like, which was unusual for him. He usually quietly eat breakfast every morning. And he was making the ruckus, and he was noticed by J.D. Tippett. J.D. Tippett was there, and he kind of looked over at Oswald at that time, which was, you know, raised a lot of interesting research over the years. As far as, like, reporting to work, he never had a time card to punch. You know, they just took his word that he was actually there. They had they would just sign a book, say, yeah, I was here. So for him to be late, they usually took his word for it that they actually were there. He was up on the sixth floor, too, so nobody was checking up on him.
Right. And this has been cited a lot of times when people are trying to, you know, put holes in the idea that he's at work definitely the whole day. And it's reasonable to understand that you could, in that circumstance, maybe slip out for a while. Maybe your supervisors don't check on you. Maybe they get to develop a pattern, in fact, where, you know, this time of day I'll go check on the place where this guy's working. And you get to know, if I'm back here by 3 o'clock, even if I took a long lunch, nobody will notice. You know,
Say. Chuck, they even interviewed a supervisor who basically said exactly that. Supervisor just said he had a logbook, and every day he would log having seen, you know, a person. It's like, this person was here today.
Right.
And that was all it amounted to. But I did want to insert one other thing that actually we need to give a lot of credit to this research to Matthew Smith, as we did last time, because he's the one who really followed this lead up with January, the FBI lead. But one of the most interesting things is, as David said, the FBI not only didn't follow up on it, but they totally misreported it. The FBI report describes this incident having occurred in the spring, whereas it actually occurred 2 days before the assassination. And Matthew Smith actually took a copy of the FBI report and showed it to January, who was irate and saying, no, he was very specific as to the date, and why in the heck would he have been concerned about something 6 months before the assassination? You know, the FBI was either totally inept, or they actually shifted the most important thing in the report, which the date on which the incident occurred.
Right, which is fascinating, because some people that had picked up on the FBI report and never bothered to pick up on the follow-up at all, you know, made assertions about this being something that happened during the summer. And not going to name names, just saying that this is something where, oh, this happened during the summer, and guess what I know about it. And turns out maybe the guy giving the report, now, look, you could make assertions that perhaps January was mistaken. I can't really agree to that being highly likely, okay? Because, again, the guy was pretty precise about a lot of details that he gave to not just the FBI, but others. And remained so. It's not like he was confused about any of this. I don't believe for a second that he transposed this into something happening a couple days before the assassination. You know, 3 days, 3 months didn't turn into 3 days. I don't think that that's what he did. It just does not, it doesn't hold water in my mind. But, and I think this is an important point because here we go. This is going to go into a lot of different directions and again, get into a lot of details, which I'm going to rely on David to give us all. Again, I've read this, but I got to tell you, it's a little hard. It's not the simplest thing to follow. So pay attention. Not you, Larry. Not you, Dave. Okay.
No. But you kidding?
I'm saying to the listener, pay attention to the details and try to formulate this. You know, in a logical way with the timelines intact. You know, keep in mind it's all important, okay? And indeed, I will say this, and again, no offense to either one of you, I think there are still indeed many missing details that could be filled in. But it's very difficult to know where to look for them at this point because, anyway, there's a lot to it. You should have seen me trying to explain to a complete novice you know, what the significance of the DRE is. You know, like, it took me a little while. You know, understand this as this, especially when you get into... Anyway, enough out of me. David, so let's go back
Chuck,
to the...
Just let me answer. Chuck, yeah. How about if... Dave, what do you think if we just retitle the whole thing to say why Oswald had to go back to his apartment to get a pistol? And, you know, like... Just get it off our chest and start out that way and answer the ultimate question. Well, maybe that's not right. Sorry, Chuck.
No, it's perfectly fine by me. If you want to give spoilers to this ahead of time, by all means. and this is part of it, but there is a lot here, and it doesn't boil down to just that. If it did, I would say to you guys, come on, this is a long way to go to get to one thing. This isn't one thing. Okay. So that's the other part of this is that little more true to life than some other people's explanations of this because, you know what, a little murky, a little incomplete details. Yeah, that's reality, honestly. You know, you never know every single thing in everybody's head, exactly what they were doing, all the things they enter. It's impossible to know all details. And funny thing is, the gaps in this almost... speak to its authenticity more than something that's completely filled in. Okay, which is weird, which is very weird. But anyway, let's get back to the story. So he has this incident. We've laid out the incident, David. And then he gives a report to the FBI. They don't seem interested to follow up on it, even from his perspective that day. What do we need to know next?
That it was mostly dropped. He actually, again, like I said, he gave an interview for the local newspaper, but he was very low-key about everything and never wanted any, you know, recognition or publicity or notoriety or anything. He just, that was his whole story. Like, this is it. This is what I saw. Do what you want with it, you know.
Okay. You know, and again, that is the kind of thing that speaks more to the authenticity of the witness in my mind. Some people that are attention seekers because they are, and that's it. And they'll seize upon, you know, the most fragmentary interaction with a piece of something that is significant, either in the news or in history or whatever. And, sorry, I've been watching American Impeachment lately. It's like Linda Tripp is really important, right? No. Okay. there is an example of somebody who thought they were very much important to the story because they needed to be important to the story. Anyway, totally, totally different reasoning here. But you could say that January didn't go out and say, look, I have the truth. I'm the guy. And he's calling up newspapers and calling up TV stations and showing up at their doorsteps and stalking reporters. Some people did these things. This guy does not. He offers a report. Doesn't seem to go anywhere. And then you don't hear from them for a while. I mean, it's just that simple. Okay, look, they don't want it. I'm not going to bother. Natural reaction, right?
Yeah, that was like lead one about the DC-3. He never said anything. He didn't want his name used at all when he talked to Matthew Smith when Matthew Smith wrote his book.
Right.
He didn't want. He just said, "This is what happened." I forgot the name he used, Hank something or other, as a alias. He just did not want attention. And after he passed away, you know, his wife talked to Matthew Smith. They gave him permission to actually use his real name for that way in January, you know, as part of the lead one. So it just shows you that he really wasn't a publicity seeker. And he was a bit concerned about the knowledge that he had. He was a little bit scared at the time.
Well, again, see lead one, because he had already interacted with people that maybe didn't want to get public notice. He knew that. So that was that. And meanwhile, does the public want to know about this? Do the authorities even want to know about this? Lead number two. Doesn't seem like it. So you know what? Maybe it's a good thing I leave it alone. I can understand that. So moving forward, you know, please continue on. And I will shut up now, because this is where we got to hang this all together. And I'm looking forward to exactly how you're going to explain it.
That's a lot of pressure. I'm going to need my buddy Larry to jump in when I get too detailed.
Yeah, feel free, Larry.
Yep. Larry, please feel free.
Yeah, I think what we have, Chuck, and you said it, the point is, what we have is an incident. You know, we can't, if you just left that, you have an incident, and at that point in time, we're left with essentially a process of reverse engineering. You can't start just in Dallas on November 20th with this much information, and it's just what it is. Mm-hmm. So what you have to start is coming up with a scenario, which is all that we present, really. It's a scenario that says, is there anything in the previous 6 months, is there any sequence of events that would put Oswald with people, with a couple, man and woman? Is there any record that we can document of Oswald associating with other people over a period of time that would have put him at that airport in conjunction with a young man or woman in that position? And if so, what would be the point of it all? So I think that's it. David, you can pursue. That's what we did next, Chuck, is really kind of like, you've got to jump back to the beginning. What would explain Oswald being associated with other people? Who would they be? Can we identify some suspects? And if so, is there a pattern in those associations that would make sense out of them showing up with him at the airport? Which is, if you think about it for just a minute, it's really Oswald, and this couple shows up with him. They leave him in the car. He's not privy to this conversation. They drive him to the airport, and you know, like, why would they even drive him to the airport?
Why would he be
He's
there?
He's not involved in the conversation.
Yeah,
they approach January for the rental. What's the whole point? So that's, we have to go back through the whole cycle. What makes sense out of that?
Well, right. And look, you know, when you're trying to figure out a crime, means, motive, opportunity, right? You got to establish these things. And fact is that I always like to start with opportunity. And Dave did that by saying, look, here's your opportunity. He's late to breakfast when he's not normally late to breakfast. That means that if you can place January's meeting with these people earlier in the day, maybe he went to work late. You got to first give him the opportunity to be there early in the morning. And that is what January said, right? They were there early. Dave?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So,
he did, you know,
you gave him opportunity right there. He could have been there if he went to work late. Okay. Now, what else is going on? Let's continue on with that sort of structure. You're going to lay this out in your presentation. You do, whether you realize it or not, where it's like, look, there's a bit more here, and we can get there. So how do we get there?
A couple ways. One is just, as we reverse engineer, like, who is he associating with the summer of New Orleans? And he's associating, you know, supposedly by himself, but who did he fight with? Who was keeping an eye on him? Who did he talk to? Who's store did he go visit? Carlos Bringer. You know, he was a member of the DRE.
Right.
And he was, as far as I know, he was the only full-time member of the DRE in New Orleans. Had, you know, a lot of friends, associates, Don Carlos Quiroga, and a couple others. Other people he associated with, Ernesto Rodriguez, who, his brother's a key player in this whole thing. So it's good, the DRE, and Bringer is letting everybody know, all his fellow members down in Miami. They report everything. They say, hey, I met, you know, who this guy is. And Jeff Morley did a great article when he actually went down and spoke to all the DRE members. Well, they've since moved on quite a bit. What was happening back then? They said, oh, yeah, we knew all about Oswald, and we shared this with all our other, you know, groups, like, you know, Alpha 66, it was Antonio Veciana. That didn't like the JURE much, but they, you know, they spread the word. Everybody knew about Oswald. He was not a stranger to everybody in the exile community. As noted by Sylvia Odio, said, oh, yeah, you know, we know who he is. He, you know, her uncle in New Orleans knew all about him, too, because he was at the his arraignment there when he was arrested. So we're looking at the DRE. So when you start looking at all these people involved, these are who he's associated with. This, they know who he is. The DRE, again, they were a lot more assets for the CIA. And they reported to George Ioannidis at the time, also known as Howard. Mm-hmm. So you know he's doing reports on them. This is what Jeff Morley's been trying for years, to actually get Ioannidis' reports on what the DRE was saying about Oswald. And can't get him. You know, he's been fighting that for years. Mm-hmm. So we went back and we looked at all the individuals in the DRE. Where did they come from? What were they doing? How were they formed? Who were the major members? What were their relationships to the CIA? Who were the case officers? And, you know, came upon some very interesting connections. Some of the early members of the DRE from, you know, DRE is essentially, it's the Student Directorate is what we popularly known as.
Right. Now, look, so, there's a Student Directorate. There is the public face of the organization. And then there is a rather contentious, still covert at that time, operational relationship with, guess who? The largest CIA station on American soil at JM Wave. Now, when it comes to Oswald, just a couple of pieces that is old hat, and you guys probably wouldn't even think to mention it. In case you don't know why Carlos Bringer is significant here, that would be the guy that Oswald got into a fight with in New Orleans in the street, got fined $10 for or something, I forget exactly how much, but some amount for, you know, disturbing the peace, and ends up, what, making the newspapers, making the TV station, getting on a radio show, and ever after we have this recording of Oswald being out there, you know, doing his whole fair play for Cuba, you know, what would we call that at this point, LARPing exercise, because he wasn't part of the Fair Play for Cuba committee, but his interactions on the Cuban question, very publicly displayed, and obviously people that were politically active about something would be aware of people that were in the public eye that had something to say about it. I mean, it's just, I mean, it's 1, 2, 3 and ABC. Sorry, I needed to throw it in, Dave, because I know we were going to skip right over it. But this is important context. And the thing about...
Just a little bit more context on that, Chuck, too, since you brought up the trial and the fine.
Mm-hmm.
It's sort of fascinating that, as David said, everybody knew about... Not everybody knew about Oswald, but certainly everyone in the Cuban community, exile community, in Miami, JM Wave. The fact that Sylvia Odio's uncle was in the courtroom hearing... Mm-hmm. Where Oswald got fined for the leafleting incident, and also the brother of a key figure in JM Wave counterintelligence work in Miami was also involved in that incident. It's just fascinating that there are connections like this that were never really brought up because they're very suggestive, and they also show that a lot more people knew about Lee Oswald and wanted to admit it after the assassination.
Well, and it also took us a long time to know about the CIA's direct involvement with the DRE, which, again, is an organization that has a purpose for the public's consumption, but quite honestly has a relationship with the CIA. Now, understand, they're not just like a creature fully owned subsidiary of the Central Intelligence Agency. There's actually something brought up in here, which I loved how you explained it, actually, in this. And I don't know who wrote it, but I think it was a great explanation that there was a contentious relationship between, and I think that's an appropriate word, between the DRE, and the CIA. Okay? And there is all of this inaction going on at the time, and somehow, you know, the later accused assassin is interacting left and right with all kinds of people that are connected with this. Now, Berenguer is the easiest example, but there have been plenty of possibilities about not only this guy being known in that community, but maybe more. And that leads to why it is he might have been sitting there with this couple. And, you know, I mean, I know that's a real basic explanation of what you took your time to lay out there. But is this not true, David, that there's... How does this come together? You know what I mean? Like, if you're trying to explain this to somebody who knows nothing, it's a very interesting pond that the alleged assassin winds up swimming in here. And then jumps out and jumps into another pond, seems like. And allegedly, he's in a lot of spots where, you know, when they're trying to buy trucks with his name, whoever did that, they're not buying it for the, Make America Great Again organization. They're trying to buy it for another Cuban organization. He's out there masquerading as a member of the Fair Play for Cuba committee, because he was never an official member, as far as I know. And there's all kinds of interaction here with a whole lot of Cuban-related stuff. I mean, is that not fair to say, Dave?
It's 100% fair to say.
Okay.
Again, you spoke about the contentious relationship between the DRE and the CIA. Yeah, that existed right until the end, when they finally disbanded the DRE. Mm-hmm. Things got so bad at one point. This was after the summer of 62. You know, we'll go into some of those details, what the DRE was doing, and certain members of the DRE going to the Helsinki World Youth Conference and disrupting it over there, to just before the Cuban Missile Crisis. Right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, they were given certain people, you know, come up with some names, who they are. They were given interviews to the New York newspapers, the Times, the CBS interviews. It got so bad that Richard Helms himself met with, you know, the leader of the DRE at the time, Luis Fernandez, and Jose Lassa. He actually had him in his office, and it was he was being the translation was Nesta Sanchez. I don't know if I go into a little detail here. Some people like the detail, but Nesta Sanchez was actually the case officer for Rolando Cubella, the guy with the poison pen on 11/22/63. That's who was translating this for them. And Helms actually said, "All right, we know we're having problems with you guys. We're going to replace the case officer you currently have, which is Russ Crozier, who's actually just had a decent article about him recently in USA Today about Russ Crozier. We're going to replace him. By December of 62, we're going to give you a new guy, and this is who you're going to report to." And they didn't give his name, but that was George Joannides. So you get Helms himself interested in this, you know, the man who kept the secrets himself, having a personal interest in this group. So you're pretty high up the chain, food chain here. So one of the things I suspect is that Joannides, you know, Helms had such an interest in Joannides and the DRE that he was receiving the reports from Joannides, and that may be part of the cover-up, because some of those reports may contain Oswald's name. So that may be why CIA covers up a lot of this also. Some of the early people that they dealt with, big name in the community here. David Morales was a case officer for the military element. William Kent could be a new name for some people. But essentially, he was George Ioannidis' supervisor while Ioannidis was at JM Wave. And Kent was also in New Orleans undercover, deep cover. We still don't know exactly what he was doing there. Kent was one of the early Cuban project. He actually met with the early DRE members. And when like Juan Salvat actually exfilled from Cuba, it was William Kent that met him in Miami. So these guys go way back. And they've dealt with some of the bigger names here. Larry, am I missing anything?
I think so. Laying the context, just to set back a bit, what we can show is that Oswald was well known to the military leaders of the DRE. He was known to the people at JM Wave who were working with the DRE. But I think one of the next steps is to kind of bring this all back, is what was the DRE doing with Lee Oswald at that point in time? And what they were doing is the DRE was making a great deal of propaganda mileage off Lee Oswald. Not only were they communicating about him to the other exile groups, as David mentioned, they were writing letters to Congress saying that Lee Oswald should be investigated because Oswald was a perfect example of how Castro and Cuba were suborning naive Americans. I mean, Lee Oswald was going to be a case study in propaganda. And that's fascinating because what happens next is clearly the DRE is very invested in Lee Oswald. They're reporting on him. They're using him for propaganda. And then supposedly, even though we can now track senior military leaders of DRE to New Orleans at exactly the same time when, quote-unquote, mysterious Cubans start talking to Lee Oswald. And you brought this up, Chuck, because Richard Case Nagel wrote about those mysterious Cubans talking to Lee Oswald, but we also have reports from at least two FBI informants in New Orleans who described the same thing. And, that was happening. And we can make a good guess as to who DRE sent back to New Orleans to start checking this guy out. But, David, to hand it back, the most interesting thing is at this point in time, when Lee Oswald appears to be a huge propaganda opportunity for DRE, who really wants to impress the CIA to keep paying them at this point in time. Ostensibly, according to them, once Lee Oswald, after the leafleting incident, they like totally don't pay any more attention to him. Nobody notices that he leaves New Orleans. Nobody monitors him. It's like he's this big deal, and then suddenly he's not. David, is that about right?
Yeah, it's about right. Lausonnier goes to Dallas, and it's quiet. Nobody says anything.
See, interesting assertion. Interesting assertion I would make here, because we're going to run low on time, and I want you to try and give us a sort of a cliffhanger before we go to break. Is that, you know, if you consider that somebody like a Berenguer, but not necessarily him, and I know I just butchered his name too, if he was aware, somebody tells him, let's say, theoretically, that Oswald is a useful asset, but you don't want people to dig too deep into the background because they might find out, you know, that Fair Play for Cuba Committee chapter doesn't exist. If somebody informed Berenguer that, or somebody like Berenguer, I should say. And that means only take this so far. I don't know why I'm thinking this way, except that it just seems logical, okay? That, look, don't dig into it too much, because it might come out to be a paper tiger, you know? I don't know. Am I out of line with that thought, Larry, just real quick before we go back to Dave and let him give us a little cliffhanger before we go to break?
No, that's certainly, and I think that's the way we've kind of viewed it up to now. It's sort of like, well, maybe there was so much going on with Oswald that everybody did just drop it. And in terms of the cliffhanger, that might have been true, you know, several years ago if you looked at this. With what we now know about Oswald's activities and about a conversation between the DRE and Mrs. Luce, something that David will go into, it turns out the DRE knew a lot more about Lee Oswald after New Orleans than they should have.
And you do mean Claire Booth Luce, right?
Yes, ma'am. Sir. Yes.
Yeah,
yes,
I would be a sir, but that's okay. No problem. Anyway,
a strong personality.
It's okay. Thing is, Claire Booth Luce. Well, gee, who would that be? You know, I don't know. Maybe Henry Luce. Oh wait, those names sound similar. Yeah, Time Life. Anybody? Anybody? Yeah. No, I know these guys know this. I'm telling you guys out there listening, but. This gets into another bit of weeds as we go further. But what should we be thinking about as we go to break? Because in the next hour, I want to really, really just let you lay this out piece by piece. You know me, the first hour is more disruptive during this show. David's getting to know that. I don't know if he's happy about it, but we'll find out.
Oh, that's fine.
But honestly, it's always these things where it's like, look, we have to bridge the gap between the known information and the misunderstandings of previous alleged information. We have to bridge that before we can get into, now, look, let me finally settle a couple of things down here and get at the real connections and get at, well, the real questions even that are still unanswered. Larry, as a side note, wouldn't it be wonderful to get your hands on the House on Un-American Activities Committee files, you know, just why would that be helpful? No reason, right, Larry? I mean, I'm just saying, if the legitimate DRE members who maybe had no knowledge about the CIA were writing to Congress, you know, trying to do the good citizen thing and saying, you know, look, you need to look into these people. I mean, of course, you know, neighbors with disputes on each other were probably calling each other communists too and everything else. But just saying. Who knows what's in those files? Guess what? Because we can't see them. We're not allowed. And might be legitimately for sources and methods. I'll leave that to the imagination of the listener, but this would be extremely helpful to put all of this in context. Larry, just rough shot, do you agree or disagree with me?
Oh, I agree. If we knew everything that was going on around Lee Oswald, I think it would, to some way, it would make the cover-up more sane, mm-hmm. because it would show us how many people were in his milieu, as it were, that would not want that to be exposed. Well, and so that's why we're never going to see it, as you see. I mean, that's there are legitimate reasons for a lot of people not to not be associated with Lee Oswald the fact.
And the funny thing is that there have been hints in other documents that perhaps, you know, either that particular committee or one just like it had some interest in Mr. Oswald previous to his, you know, getting into the spotlight as the alleged assassin. Okay. And we've seen this before, and that's why I'm saying there's just a black hole there where you can't go any further because nobody's letting that stuff loose yet. You want to talk about, and meanwhile, still a lot of files not going to be released and all that, but you're going to have to check out the Lancer conference for it. So, David, because we've opened up all these possibilities, as I said, I think it's going to be great to hear you nail them down in the next hour. But going forward with the story of Oswald, now he's in the milieu, which I think is the word Larry used, of a great many of these individuals who are in a universe that kind of ends up being, pardon the pun, in the AM world, and might give us some hints, too. I didn't know there was two, by the way. Anyway, AM hint, AM world, this stuff is all going to come up in the discussion in the next hour, okay? And it's a bit complex, but I think this is really great information. So what should we leave them with thinking for a couple of minutes as we go to break, David?
Probably maybe re-looking at the Acuña incident where Oswald and a guy called Hernandez went to go buy rifles from Acuña and Houston. So that might be interesting. We'll dig into possibilities, who that person is and how it relates to what where we're going with this.
No, absolutely. And it's interesting to me that Oswald is a constant shopping buddy. I know I'm making a joke here, but think about it for a minute. He's with the guys trying to buy trucks. He's with the guys, or the couple, excuse me, trying to rent an airplane. He's out there trying to buy rifles. I mean, look, I understand that a lot of things were figments of people's imaginations that were active after the assassination, but some of this stuff, after a while, you know, the old, if there's so much smoke, something's got to be burning. I know I just said that all wrong, but you know what I'm saying. You know, there's got to be something to this. The guy's name is being used in places where he cannot be. The guy is constantly being, oh, wait a minute. This is either a legitimate situation or it's somebody's attempt to make it look like a legitimate situation ahead of the time of the assassination, before anybody can be speculating about a grand crime. Because previous to this, what has he got? Disturbing the peace? Oh, he defected to Russia, but nobody really did anything about that. And I don't know what he violated there. Kind of hard to know with the CIA people at the embassy there in Russia. A lot of open questions, David. Is that a fair way to leave this here? Oswald the shopping buddy. And why would that matter?
Right. Time to certain people.
Fair enough.
I would extend it just a little bit. I would even go further than shopping. I would say the story from New Orleans on is that of radicalizing Lee Oswald. You've already associated him with Cuba, and now you need to make him look a little more dangerous.
You know, you stole my transition for the next hour, because that's what I was going to add to it. Anyway, that's fine. Larry Hancock and David Boylan with me, and we are discussing January lead number 2 in the JFK assassination. That's what I'm calling it. They're probably going to call it something else, but it's because this is the genesis point in my mind where you have a seemingly legitimate and not so anxious to share witness who remained consistent, appears stable, and has been misused and misunderstood for a long time. So we're going to go into this further, like I said, with Dave and Larry in the next hour. Stick around. The Ocelli Effect will return after this.
Revelation through conversation.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com. Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough.
Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
Go there now.
Go there now.
This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and you're listening to The Ocelli Effect at Ocelli.com.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia. By author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before. That'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, nuclear bombs and nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why?
The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before.
It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it.
Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com. Ocelli.com.
Going to Chuck Ocelli.
With me tonight, Larry Hancock, David Boylan, and we are discussing, well, what I'm calling the JFK January Lead 2. Could be there is a better title out there for it, and I'm sure these gentlemen will come up with it by the time they actually publish it. You are hearing about something that has not been fully published and will be. Is this going to be something featured at the Lancer Conference, Larry?
Yes, we'll be presenting on two different presentations at the Lancer Conference, both Redbird incidents. We'll have separate presentations hour long.
There you go. So you're going to get 2 hours, which will be more compact and without the disruptive voice of myself involved. So there you go. David, I want to turn it right back over to you. And why? Because I want to give maximum time for you to lay out the rest of this. Like I said, at the end of the last hour. Interesting, you've got Oswald coming up with all these fascinating people. And Larry, during the break, brought up some of the media-related individuals that might have gotten involved in this very odd case. Now, how does this link to the January lead? It certainly does, because, again, that's our starting point. And we're explaining the context, the universe, and the, well, the landscape by which this might have occurred. And often ignored landscape, honestly. Although there have been focuses on the anti-Castro Cubans in the past, new information has emerged. More information has emerged. Greater understandings of these organizations and their interactivity with U.S. government-based organizations has become available over the years. And you guys have essentially assembled this. So, look, enough out of me. Where do we go from here? And like I said, I'm literally going to turn my microphone off and let you and Larry lay this out the rest of the way, best we can, for the rest of this hour. So, by all means, my friend, go ahead.
All right, let's start off with the McEwen incident. That's kind of like, you know, just before he leaves New Orleans, and he actually, I'm going to make sure I get this right. I'll actually crib some of my notes here from the paper. He approached, there was an approach to a former gun runner, Robert McEwen. He purchased and transported weapons for the revolution against Batista. McEwen was actually good friends with Fidel Castro. He was such good friends that Castro actually visited him in the United States. This guy is just not an ordinary guy or ordinary gun runner. He supplied Castro back in the day and a lot of the revolutionary groups on the island. He smuggled in materials by boat, and some of them were sailing out of Louisiana through Mexican ports to Cuba. He had been charged and convicted with weapons violation. But following that, he had a lot of media attention. It was personally visited by Fidel Castro following the revolution. On one of his boat trips to Cuba, Robert McKeown, had become acquainted with a number of Cubans involved in the revolution. One of them was Jorge Sotis. Sotis was arrested and convicted along with McKeown back in the day. So that's what becomes interesting, because you got McKeown, those Castro, actually went to Cuba, and one of the people he recognized with Lee Harvey Oswald, his last name was, he recognized him as Hernandez. And that is one of the people we've actually looked at as being part of possibly setting him up. Because we know that Carlos Hernandez was in New Orleans late July, early August, as part of the McClaney-Lacombe set up there, where they were going to actually drop bombs on Cuba. We suspect that was a DRE operation at the time. So that's interesting. You got Oswald, who did the talking, and Hernandez did the driving. And it was a Chevy station wagon. And it seems like Carlos Hernandez also liked to drive, and he liked to drive station wagons. Because when he was actually rented a car in Miami, and he drove that to New Orleans for the end of July.
Right. Now, real quick, if Larry could add to this, or unless you want me to try and talk fast through it, you mentioned this circumstance with the bombs. It's more remarkable than you just gave it credit for, David, because it's hard for somebody to wrap their mind around this operation, which was very sort of kind of haphazard in a way, and almost unimaginable to an American today to realize that, you know, there was this covert activity happening. You know, I mean, this literally involves a dynamite guy from Alabama and surplus practice casings, you know, for bombs and possibly planes that, I mean, all this stuff coming together in this very weird sort of clandestine operation on American soil. These are not guys who are just sitting there talking or giving speeches, Larry, that we're talking about here, is it?
And I think perhaps most significant for our interest in here, this was organized by DRE military leaders. Mm-hmm. The pilot that was involved in it said that it was a DRE operation. As you said, Chuck, it involved explosives out of the Chicago area, B-26 aircraft that most probably were coming out of Houston, which rings a bell if you remember lead number one. Mm-hmm. Guys driving from Miami to New Orleans, including Carlos Hernandez, and bringing a group of non-local Miami Cubans into New Orleans at the same time that reportedly Oswald was being contacted by non-local mysterious Cubans. But more significantly than that, this is all going on when these same guys are still working for the CIA, being employed by the CIA on military missions, having been ordered not to do anything at all against Cuba, and they are once again demonstrating that they are totally rogue, following their own agenda when they want to. Mm-hmm. And it, regardless of what the CIA wants, they're going to do their own thing when they want to do it.
Well, maybe I'm misremembering something here, but the guy from Alabama with the dynamite too is like, this was not something we have a centralized location. We're going to do something here, and that's it. They were pulling together all these weird kind of things that weren't exactly
very ambitious, and they had, of course, they had tried to do it first in Miami. Their first attempt at a bombing mission was in Miami. But the FBI and every government agency was all over the Cubans in Miami. And so literally these guys realized that if they were going to do something, you know, untoward, that the CIA didn't, you know, we're going to operate even outside the CIA's purview. They had to make it happen outside of Florida, which is why you find them starting to go to New Orleans and to Dallas, for that matter, operating outside of Florida.
But simultaneously, David, simultaneously still in operations with JM Wave and the CIA, and sometimes following their rules and sometimes not. Am I wrong about that?
Some of the same guys at the McClaney's ended up going to Nicaragua and World, and they ended up being Chichi Quintero's commandos. Literally, they were on the same list of Chichi. No, they were commandos. They were highly trained individuals. Some of them were actually trained. Carlos Hernandez was trained by Carl Jenkins, Rip Robertson, Tom Kleins. These were all big CIA heavyweights back in the day. And Hernandez was originally trained to be a member of the cadre, which was for the Bay of Pigs with early trainer. He was trained to be a trainer of other, you know, anti-Castro members as part of the whole Bay of Pigs. So, I mean, you're looking at some heavyweight guys here. These people are not just your average run-of-the-mill guys. John Koch, K-O-C-H, I don't know if it's Cook or Koch, he was also highly trained, and he was actually a commando with Chichi Quintero, again, some of the early raids on Cuba in 62.
Could be Coke, by the way, just saying, with that spelling.
Be.
Yeah, go ahead.
Could be Coke, Cook, or Koch. I don't think they used the... There would be an E at the end of it. I think it was Koch.
Yeah, okay, either way.
But, yeah, these guys, they were just not average run-of-the-mill guys. You know, also Victor Espinosa Hernandez was also there. You know, he was highly trained. He was one of the original infiltrators for the Bay of Pigs. Miguel Alvarez, again, highly trained. He was one of the, again, he was the commando leader of an infiltration team just before the Bay of Pigs, highly trained. And interestingly enough, there was a Miguel Alvarez on the bus, I think, that Oswald was on, that went to Mexico City. Coincidence, I believe, if you believe that.
Well, the counter-argument to that is Miguel Alvarez. I've run across, you know, probably 15 guys named Miguel Alvarez in my life. You know, so it's possible. Some people say that and just leave it at that, but I got you. Go ahead.
How many are in New Orleans at the same time Oswald is, and, you know, so.
And involved in exactly this kind of stuff. Yeah, I got you. But I'm just saying, but it's one of those things. Yeah.
Something I think we haven't considered and to focus in on. So the first time we see Lee Oswald in a context after New Orleans, when everybody is supposedly ignoring him, he's trying to buy guns to use in invading a foreign country, a Central American country. The reason they want guns from McCowan, and McCowan knows what's going on. It's sort of like, why would people that he knew that was part of the Castro Revolution show up trying to buy guns to export a revolution in Central America where Castro was trying to export revolutions? So suddenly, if you take that, we now have Lee Oswald going from being a, you know, just leafleting on the street to buying guns to support a Castro-oriented revolution in Central America, which is pretty darn interesting, which you might consider to be the first step in, you know, like radicalizing his image. The only thing that he had done right before that was to write a letter to the Communist Party asking them if he should go underground, you know. So between those two things, he starts to begin to look a little more radical. And I'll hand it back to David.
No, that's a point. It's a good point. He was going to buy it with the three rifles. He gave some outrageous figure, like $10,000 to purchase three rifles. And McCowan said, that's it. You know, these guys are nuts. And he turned them down. So that was, again, was this dirty enough? Because McCowan, because being such good friends with Castro, is this, you know, putting Oswald in the, you know, like, dealing with one of Castro's buddies is pot dirtying him up also. So that's interesting.
Well, everything from his public support to his associations, it almost seems like, and what's funny is, you almost, outside of the news media immediately being able to distribute the audio from New Orleans all over the country, it wasn't something that they kept on with about, it was like just there to make the point he's, you know, a commie, basically. But other than that, it wasn't about the specifics of why is this Cuba? Why is this kid, you know, poor kid from New Orleans, goes into the Marines, defects to the Soviet Union? That's as far as they go, but they don't go into, well, who did he know? What did he really do? I don't know. It just, that's the way it seemed to be for decades, anyway, in my mind, and would have remained that way completely, I think, had not we learned later that, you know, there was a lot of American involvement in things like, I don't know, ZR rifle, you know, stuff like that. I'm just saying. After a while, you got to, again, if there's enough smoke, you got to ask what's exactly burning, because something is. So.
Well, and we don't know, Joe, one of the things we don't know, and you had mentioned it earlier, we don't know what other incidents there may have been. You know, it's kind of like the January incident. There probably were other incidents of Oswald doing things that were radical, that were suspicious, you know, after the fact, maybe not at the time, but there probably was a reason for people not to rush to inform the press that they had been in contact, you know, with a guy trying to buy weapons or practicing target shooting or whatever with a guy who killed the president. So all we can do is pick bits and pieces here to try to make a pattern. And of course, the next step in kind of radicalizing Oswald. So we've got him at McCallum's as maybe being involved in, you know, Castro-oriented revolutions in Central America, buying in guns. And the next time we see him turn up, and I'll turn it back to David, is in Dallas at Sylvia Odio's, where he's going to be described as a loose cannon who could do anything and kill anybody.
Yeah, that's Sylvia Odio. That whole visit's puzzled many of us for many, many years. I mean, we look at, you know, she said they were members of JUR, but they didn't recognize them. Were they, or the members of DRE, and she was protecting them because her sister Sarita Odio was a member of the DRE and met with various DRE members in Dallas. And correct me if I'm wrong here, Larry, but weren't they originally looking for Sarita and not Sylvia?
Yes, when they actually banged they had originally asked for Sarita. And I think along with that, David, let's lay out, so I'll let you do it. But the context is by October, the DRE is very active in Dallas. It's not just, you know, these are mysterious Cubans that may have been calling, misrepresenting themselves. But what David has turned up and we've established is that there, at this same time, there are a number of DRE leaders, and including men and women, in Dallas, and that Sylvia Odio has been, very much involved in trying to buy weapons. She's a known fact. There's a lot of things going on in Dallas that make life very interesting in a way to introduce Lee Oswald among this group of Cuban exiles in Dallas. But yes, they were looking for Sarita, and there's every reason to think one of the things that makes the Odio incident as real is that Sylvia said that when these people called on her, two men and Oswald, they knew the war name of her father. And interestingly enough, her father wrote to her and said, no, she had obviously written to him, and he wrote back to her and said, no, nobody knows my war name that would be visiting you. You know, the only people that knew it were people in Cuba before he had been put into prison. And interestingly enough, some of those same people would have been associated with the DRE. Back to you, David.
And his war name also was well known by members of the CIA. So if these people were sent by the CIA or they were acting on their own, that's interesting. I believe his CIA name was Cesar. That was the name of his son also. They called Cesar Odio's farm where he was arrested. And a couple other people were arrested there. That's part of the early assassination plots against Castro back in 61 before Veciana took off. He was associated with the Odios, which is interesting in itself. Not to get too far, but was it Jure or was it, you know, the DRE members? And was Sylvia covering for them or not? That's a tough one to decide, to know. Try to think some of the other people that possibly. Well, one of the guys we were looking at as, you know, possibly as accompanying Oswald to Dallas, which again, we mentioned him, was Carlos Hernandez. Hernandez, although a member of the DRE one time and also a member of Manuel Adame, he was actually Adame's bodyguard at one point. So they're very close to Quintero, who we mentioned. That's why Quintero wanted him to be a commando for AmWorld. So this guy was, you know, highly trained. He had previously gone to Helsinki as part of the whole disruption concept there. There was like 9 people went, all were CIS assets, all had PO provisional operational agreements signed. Some of those members actually ended up, you know, one was John Koch that we mentioned. Mm-hmm. He was also there. So we know there were CIA assets. And a couple of the other people that were in Helsinki too were Manuel Salvat and Anita Diaz Silveira. And they also happened to appear in Dallas also in October doing fundraising. And that was one of the initial, you know, ideas of the reasons for these people to visit Sylvia Odio. They were fundraising, mm-hmm. even though they thought they were looking for Sarita. So that was really interesting.
Well, and just for the public's knowledge, right, there was this incident in Finland where there are a lot of, you know, a lot of student groups come together. There was clearly some sort of demonstration that took place, right? And, I mean, I'm giving very broad strokes here because I don't want to get caught in it too much. But just for context about the people you're talking about, you know, a couple of them end up with semi-automatic or automatic pistols, which did not make the people in Finland too happy. They were sort of disruptive at this student gathering of sorts. It did, you know, get out there, and there were a couple of arrests and this kind of thing. And one wonders, you know, why CIA assets with, you know, operational, provisional operational agreements are doing this, right? I mean, is that not a logical question, Larry?
It becomes fascinating. It's like Anita and Salvat and Carlos Hernandez seem to be part of this core team who are engaged. Salvat is the head of propaganda for the DRE by 62-63. He's also been heavily involved with the DR military. And the DRE, as David's pointed out, have demonstrated that they will go their own way. And they simply, they might take money from the CIA and they might be approved for missions, but when they get off on their own, they do their own thing. And yeah, Chuck, it's amazing what the CIA appears to have, knowing how out of control they were, they kept letting them go. They didn't rein them in. So you have to wonder, you know, was there a case officer involved that was encouraging them to do some things that maybe headquarters didn't know about? One of the things that becomes very confusing to David and I at this point, to really shortcut this, is there's every sign that people from DRE were involved with Lee Oswald after New Orleans, that he was being positioned for something increasingly radical, yet whether or not that was part of a legitimate CIA propaganda operation, or whether or not that was the beginning of setting him up as part of the framing him in conspiracy, eludes us. Because it could go either direction. Pretty much at any point in time, from McCallan on through Odio to the airport at Redbird, and it's like, who's really playing this game with Oswald? Someone's playing a game with him. You know, is someone hijacking a propaganda game to make him, to frame him? But David, would you agree, as soon as we get to Dallas, we're confused. It could go either way.
Yeah, totally confusing. Again, not a lot is known about, you know, all of Oswald's doings in Dallas. We know some of them, you know, some are documented. We know what he's doing here and there. But again, who was he associating with? Was he? So, I mean, the people who were just mentioned previously, they gave at least five known fundraising speeches that we know about, which was Anita Diaz and Juan Salvat and a couple other people. This is before they started. Oh, Larry will help me out with this, but actually trying to get weapons from John Thomas Mason, that actually sent people there. So it's all at the same time period. It's all the same thing. They're giving speeches, fundraising funds, and all of a sudden they're also looking for weapons through Mason.
And there are a couple of unknown Cubans who we certainly wish we knew the names of, but one of the reasons we suspect Carlos Hernandez might have been there is in one incident that's well documented in the reports, at one of the speeches that unnamed Cubans were giving at a fundraiser, the fellow giving the speech became so animated that something had to be done about President Kennedy, and that they were going to do something about President Kennedy, that when he realized he had been tape recorded saying that, he threatened the guy with the tape recorder and forced him to give him the copy of the tape. And the interesting thing is he told him that if he didn't give it to him, he would suffer the consequences of his being a trained expert in martial arts. And it just so happens, David, what'd you find about our friend, Mr. Carlos Hernandez?
Well, he was a black belt in judo. So, and that's what he actually said, you know, I'm a black belt, when he was threatening the guy to give him the tape back. So, and the point is, Carlos actually gave speeches, you know, in Helsinki. That was the point with Salvat and Anita Diaz. They were on stage together, so it's not unusual that they would appear together. So, was it Hernandez? We don't know. Is he a possibility? Yes. So.
Right. But there are photographs of some of these things. Right?
Of the speeches?
Of the speeches, like, right?
And the fundraising? Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. Well, I'm just saying there's photographic evidence. It's not like, you know, there's some legend about speeches. It's there's evidence that these things did actually occur and would have occurred, but there's multiple layers of what occurs here. There's the public face of it, and then there is possibly encoded propaganda, communications being given publicly. There's all kinds of possibilities here.
In the after meetings, you know, who did they meet with afterwards? We know some of the people they met with and where they went to various apartments, and we have a report from Trudy Castor, you know, Colonel L. Robert Castor was a gun runner from Dallas, and they attended the meetings, and General Edwin Walker also attending these meetings. His name's on a list. He donated money to the DRE. Anita Diaz, she actually was questioned by the FBI, and she gave them the list of one of the meetings. She said there was essentially October 13th, there was two different meetings. One was for the Spanish-speaking public. The other was for the English-speaking public later on. Mm-hmm. So it's quite a bit of detail what was actually going on and where they met afterwards. and who they.
And one of the rumors floating around in the Cuban community was that Lee Oswald had actually attended one or more of the fundraising sessions, might even have signed a roster, and Salvat himself was questioned about that, and it's sort of fascinating. When he was questioned, Salvat said, "Oh yeah, I heard the rumors when we were there, and there was talk that this Lee Oswald fellow might have been in some of our meetings, and I heard the rumors," and it's sort of like, okay.
Yeah, Salvat, but I didn't see him though.
I didn't see him though. I didn't care. You know, it's sort of like, so the guy who was a major focus of DRE propaganda back in New Orleans just about 6 or 8 weeks earlier is in Dallas attending their meetings, and Salvat doesn't care and didn't investigate it and didn't try to put Oswald under surveillance and didn't make any reports about Oswald being in Dallas. He just, again, seems amazingly unconcerned about the guy who was the center of all their propaganda in August.
Yeah, it's not like he's a guy from a couple of years ago or something, you know. it's just very, very odd. So how do we take this story further, David? Because, you know, about 25 more minutes here, and I would like to kind of complete the thumbnail sketch, so to speak.
I'm going to let Larry talk about Claire Booth Luce.
We didn't go back to that. You're right.
Nope.
Yeah, okay. Yeah. So, yeah, Larry, go ahead.
So one of the things we're left with, okay, and we've admitted that this is research. This is exploration. All we're doing is looking at a scenario that would explain how people showed up at Redbird with Lee Oswald. Okay, so another piece of information that we do have, and one of the things that strongly suggests that the DRE was involved with Lee Oswald after New Orleans, that they knew where he was, that they knew what he was doing, that their people might have had some contact with him. Where would we find that? You know, obviously the FBI had ample opportunity to develop that information and totally wasn't interested, so we covered that. Well, Claire Booth Luce actually, during the House Select Committee inquiries and later, and during even during the Garrison investigations, brought forth the possibility that she had been given information that Lee Oswald was part of an actual Castro conspiracy to kill the president, and that people should be investigating a Cuban hit team. And the reason that she knew this was the fact that a year earlier, when the DRE had staged a very sensational boat mission into Havana Harbor and tried to shoot the place up very successfully and made all sorts of headlines, she had been turned on to them as a very effective group that could use some financial support. And she had actually made some money available for DRE boat operations and had talked to some of their military leaders. And so what her story was, that after the assassination, early in the evening of the assassination, she had gotten a call from one of the DRE military people that she'd been familiar with before, and he told her several very interesting things in the conversation that, you know, they wanted to make sure that the world knew and the media knew and you know, the FBI knew, but mostly the media. Obviously, she is married to the guy who runs the Luce media empire. And they told a variety of things, including the fact that they had actually information that Lee Oswald, and they had taped, actually, Lee Oswald threatening to kill people, killing government leaders, that they had information that Lee Oswald had been in Mexico. They had information that Lee Oswald was actually part of a Castro hit team, that he was a gunman, very claims that you don't really want to make to the FBI unless you have some proof, you know, very explosive claims that would would suggest that they had had information about Lee Oswald, you know, virtually up to the time of the attack. Now, of course, the interesting thing about that is you would think that DR with their, you know, DRA with their close relationship with the CIA, if they had really known that Lee Oswald, you know, was making threats against government leaders and was part of a Cuban hit team, that they would have shared that with their case officer. I mean, they're looking to do anything they can to impress the CIA so the CIA keeps giving them money, but they knew all this and they don't share it. So this becomes a really important thing that David and I think has not received the attention that it should, given the fact that it seems to substantiate the DRE's involvement with Oswald after New Orleans, and in very particular, that there was no way anybody in the public knew Lee Oswald had been in Mexico. In fact, after the fact, there was a lot of effort made investigating the fact that he was there, but other than the CIA and the FBI and, you know, the national security agencies, the DRE should not have been able to tell Clair Booth Luce that he had come, had been in Mexico, and, you know, that's where he had gotten in touch with this Cuban hit team. David, did I capture most of it, or can you add something?
No, I think you did. I think you mentioned what was William Pauley himself who pulled Clair Booth Luce into it to help her fund the boats, and one of the person's names was Julio Fernandez, she said, which was pretty much a made up name. She kind of admitted that. And we looked at that for quite a bit, and we had one suspect in mind, was Juan Blanco, Juan Fernandez Blanco. And he was a member of the DRE. He was a boatman. He was a pilot. He was hired by Lead One, you know, Manuel Villafana, to work in the maritime operations. We also suspect he was the Julio Fernandez that Bradley Ayers mentioned in his book, The Zenith Project. He was also a boatman, a young guy, and he was friendly and he spoke great English. Larry, do you want anything about
I think a significant thing is, and this will ring bells with Chuck, I suspect, is of course this is the individual that the FBI tracked down who had been in Chicago only a few weeks before the assassination and was likely the source of the Homer Echeverria report that the exiles were going to be able to act against Cuba because they had funding, and as soon as JFK was taken out of the picture, they would be allowed to move. So it's kind of interesting that you would have that kind of talk apparently circulating within senior CIA, or sorry, senior DRE military leaders at the same time this is going on in Dallas. We've got their people in Dallas, we've got their people in Chicago, and it seems like DRE knows something is going on, and that they're very, very much committed to something being done to take JFK out of the picture. But I guess the way I'd sum it up is the loose information is another route into this, suggesting that the DRE knew more about Oswald and was actually doing something with Lee Oswald after New Orleans. Had him under surveillance, was in contact with him, knew about his movements, which of course takes us back to the essential question is, could the DRE itself, could DRE members have been involved in manipulating him, radicalizing him, creating the image of Lee Oswald that was going to be used to point towards Castro and Cuba in regard to the assassination?
And yet, post-assassination, you still have Hoover complaining that in the marginalia of a report at one point saying, you know, they're giving me a bit of a snow job here. regarding Mexico City, which involves what? Oswald allegedly being, and this is not information that the American public had in any sort of detail whatsoever for a long, long time. So, how does Claire Booth Luce have this information? Or even a sense of it? That's a great point. So, go ahead.
We think what happened, or I would speculate what happened, is the night of the assassination, these guys were excited. I mean, they were excited. They knew something. They knew something was supposed to have happened. It had happened. And it was very important that they helped get this message across that it was Castro. And that they said too much when they were talking with her. They may not have realized, and we've talked about this, Chuck, before, is that, I mean, as John Martino said, hey, things didn't happen the way they were supposed to in Dallas. The second part of this thing, to point towards Castro, didn't come off as it was supposed to. So we have to deal with the fact that people were trying to sell this Castro hit team slash Oswald the evening of the assassination, the day after the assassination, when there were probably pieces of evidence in that were to be in play that didn't make it into play. And so, literally, when they're talking to Luce, they say something that maybe seemed safe enough at the moment. Yeah, everybody's going to know Oswald was part of a Castro hit team because that's part of the plan. And when it didn't happen, well, that was embarrassing, but nobody picked up on it. And for that matter, we didn't pick up on it.
Right.
You know, it's been hanging out there. But when you combine it with this whole scenario that appears to connect the DRE to Oswald beyond New Orleans, it makes it a lot more interesting.
And then going back to January, well, why is he there with a Cuban couple getting a... Yeah, I'm just trying to connect the dots here, and it's a little difficult. Of course, we could go into Chicago and all that, but I find it remarkable that privileged information ends up coming out of the mouths of people at inconvenient times, and hints at privileged information come out of the mouths of people that really shouldn't have it. Seems to happen quite a bit here in this scenario. Am I wrong, David?
No, you're right.
Okay.
It's like, oops.
Whoops.
Little things sneak out.
Well, where did that come
from? And just think about what had happened. We know, we talked last time about January has some connections in selling aircraft to the CIA. He has some reasons to be conservative in ways. What if Ray January had gone to the meeting that night, gone to the news media that night and said, hey, Lee Oswald, it was my place with its Cubans, and they're trying to set up an aircraft that they're going to hijack to Cuba. What if that had hit the headlines?
Mm.
Just imagine how different it could have been. So, you know, we only know what happened. We don't know what was expected to happen. And if you think about it, that visit to the airport, my view is there are two things that it could tell you, that's part of literally positioning Lee Oswald, you know, okay. It puts him with other people, hijacking an aircraft to Cuba helps kind of sell this whole story. But the other thing, frankly, it does, because they don't let Lee Oswald out of the car, is as far as Lee Oswald is concerned, he may think that he's scheduled to fly out of Cuba or fly out of Dallas that week to Cuba. And if he is under some sort of management and manipulation or control, it certainly adds an element of control to Lee Oswald, who, and this is something I'll let David discuss, who Lee Oswald is on record as previously, even as far back as New Orleans, having discussed being so frustrated about getting to Cuba that maybe he should just go ahead and hijack an airplane. David, over to you.
That's a interesting one. We know in the summer of 63, yeah, he was actually talking to his wife, Marina, about hijacking an aircraft to Cuba, and he had maps and everything he was showing her. So do we believe her or not? But she seemed to have quite a bit of detail about this, and she was pretty adamant that, yes, he wanted to hijack an aircraft and go to Cuba. He had, you know, all the maps, everything. And she refused to help him with any effort and said, if you get there, I'll join you there. But he never made it there, obviously. Mm-hmm. That's when he did, you know, obtain the Mexican tourist visa, you know, and wanted to travel to Cuba. So was that one of the reasons he was, because he, you know, wanted to hijack a plane to get his Cuban visa? I don't know. But is that why he was trying to develop that image? Was somebody, you know, about his credentials, that he was pro-Castro and, you know, FPCC? I don't know. It's a lot of unknowns, but it's interesting.
Well, it's a lot of unknowns, but here's one last thing. And then, you know, because I want to just have this discussion with Larry and then turn it over to you, David, to conclude this any which way you see fit. And we do have a time constraint, but you know what? I'll just run it over on the podcast and give you as much time as you want or don't want. It's fine. It'll be there for you. So, Larry, one other thing to consider here, just objectively, as I'm saying to myself, well, are we talking about a real operation? Are we talking about a cover story being arranged so that you have lots of supporting details and characters to add to it? Something that is often not mentioned by individuals who don't necessarily understand these flowcharts so much. Yes, they can follow a storyline, but, you know, there is often more than one cover story in play. So that if you have an operation that you want to definitely have misdirection over, and we know this from not the JFK assassination even, but looking at what we might call the assassination guide, arranging multiple cover stories, having a primary one, but always having a backup, you know, in case the operation doesn't go to the point where you can just leave it all up to mystery, have a fall guy ready to go. This kind of thing. It is possible that this was the cover story that was being arranged for somebody else that didn't come to fruition because it just couldn't be sold or it wasn't even necessary. What could it be not necessary for? Well, one glaring fact, Lee Harvey Oswald died in captivity before he could give any more than a couple of minutes worth of a statement to the public. So you could cover this up by not even bothering to allow this to come to light. You got your cover up because he's dead. He can't possibly blow any other cover story on you. So that's the end of that, if you can make every loose end wrap up that way. The other consideration is, say, you're a completely wholly different group of assassins engaged in that. You could be arranging a Cuban cover story, and Oswald's useful because you could arrange a Russian cover story. Hey, he was already set with this mission when he came back from Russia. Now, I'm not saying I go with that, especially considering the fact that former CIA agents are making an entire documentary series out of that nonsense. But I'm just saying that if I go objectively and I don't look at the tainted narratives out there, and I try and formulate this, there may have indeed been more than one cover story. In which case, the reason why you have gaps here is because they didn't need to complete the puzzle. Right? I mean, I'm just thinking of that objectively. Yeah. What do you say to that, Larry?
Absolutely. I think there are two ways to view it. I mean, well, there are more than two ways to view it. Well, one simple way to view it is if the attack itself was a rogue CIA operation of JM Wave field officers to eliminate Kennedy, having a cover story that would point it towards Cuba would be very handy. Mm-hmm. I mean, for them, that kills two birds with one stone. They've been trying to get Castro anyway. Do they really need that cover story after Lee Oswald is dead? No. In fact, it actually would become embarrassing, because if you really investigated Oswald and his connections to other people, you don't want to go there. That would start you ask about its connections to you guys. You know, so yeah, Chuck, I can see that. It's something that after Oswald is dead, you just let die. You know, mm-hmm. whatever you might have had, you let it die. The other But the other scenario I think I'd have to bring up is there's every sign that the CIA out of Miami Station, Jam Wave, had a program, at least one program initiated, and probably two, using Oswald, at least Oswald's image, Oswald's identity, in counterintelligence and propaganda operations. Every sign of that. Now, the quandary is, to do that, they may have been using some of these same individuals who were very well aware of what was going on and who may literally have hijacked what would have been official, approved, sanctioned day job operations using Oswald for legitimate intelligence purposes, hijacked him to bring him in for a cover story for the assassination that would point towards Castro. Flip a coin. Mm-hmm. But certainly, whether it's a cover that wasn't needed or whether it's the hijacking of an operation that, of course, nobody's going to want to talk about afterwards. And we can see that. We can see that they actually chose not to talk about it. There were people like Joannides and Kent and Moore that knew about Oswald that did not talk about it during the official investigations. Why? Why would they not do that? Clearly, there's only one reason, because that would have exposed their connection to him. Right. But it's not that they were just ignorant. They chose not to talk about things they knew about. So, yeah, I would sum it up. You can have covers. You can have – it all boils down to the way I would wrap it up. It's a scenario where Oswald is being used and maneuvered by people. And we can't tell you which exact scenario it is, but when he shows up, assuming it's him at Redbird, that's part of the effort to both frame him and keep him under control. David, elaboration?
Yeah.
Disagreement?
No, there's that whole possible hijack and piggyback on sending Oswald to Mexico, whether it was counterintelligence that sent up there. Not to go into too much detail, but there was a huge effort to recruit Azque, then, from the Cuban embassy. Huge. They know, CIA knew they were under a deadline, I think October 14th. He was scheduled to go back to Havana. And all summer they were trying to recruit him. They were sending some of Tony Sforza's guys that they knew from Cuba to go in there and help recruit him. They're getting pressure from Winston Scott to actually say, hey, what's taking you guys so long? You guys going to recruit him? Send Cassis back in. This is all around this relevant time period, September, end of September. Then all of a sudden you see Oswald meeting with Askew. Coincidence? I don't know. Was he really there? Or they have Oswald and somebody else impersonating Oswald at the same time trying to recruit Askew. But I won't go into too much detail. There's a lot there. There's a lot of meat there. Who was meeting with who and who was running it. So you got Tony Sforza, who's huge at JM Wave, and he's sending people to Mexico City. They knew who Oswald was. So did they send him? Again, like Ernesto Rodriguez, his brother is Emilio Rodriguez. He worked with and for Tony Sforza at JM Wave. So did Ernesto Rodriguez help send him to Mexico, point him in the right direction? I don't know. There's a lot going on there. Larry, anything you want to add to that? Or that's a big possible piggyback?
No. Let me put a final question in play here. Okay, and we'll wrap it up on this. However, you guys want to respond to it, I think this is the most relevant inquiry that is inspired by this work. Okay, and it's pretty simple. Whether you concede that there is a real operation here, or this is, for lack of better terminology, just legend building for some other purpose. It seems to me as though there is far too many possibilities that are there for there not to be a legend-building operation here, where Oswald is definitely being built upon and built up, kind of fabricated, so that eventually you can say, look, the guy, he's got his Fair Play for Cuba committee membership, he's, you know, trying to purchase weapons, he's trying to purchase trucks, he's trying to purchase, he's along with the couple that's there trying to get an airplane. Even when you think of Marina's statement, right, you have a whole legend here, which is either fabricated or part of a real operation, or how about both? And the purpose of it is still unclear based on what it is you guys have laid out in my mind. But the basis of the idea that there is certainly an intentional building of bona fides for this one guy, and you know, with reasonable evidence that could be laid out at some point, whether it's internally within the you know, the secretive part of the government, or it's in public, all of it, actually, you know, we'll give this to the public, we'll give this to the government, we'll give this to the superiors in D.C., or maybe they were aware of it already, we'll give this to the president, we'll give this to the Warren Commission, doesn't necessarily mean you got to give all the groceries in the bag to one person to eat. And it seems like they built a legend here. And there's a lot of different things like this that could be brought together. But it's fascinating because, well, why is it you would do this? The end question always ends up being why. Now, I'm not saying that I expect you guys to answer that. But you could make assumptions about what this is useful for, who this is useful to. But I think it's hard to argue with the idea that it's being done, and it's certainly being done intentionally. And I don't know, I, you know, just didn't meet Lee Harvey Oswald. None of us did, right? It would be hard to know if it was something that he dreamed up all by himself, but doesn't seem likely. So you got to think somebody else outside of him came up with it. Now, what was their purpose and what was it meant to accomplish? Therein lies the, you know, the $20,000 question they used to say. I think that's where it is, Larry. Or maybe I should go to David first with this. Actually, I will. I'll go to David first. Is that not the ultimate question here? I mean, there's a lot more in this documentation that you guys are referencing in this this piece, which I don't know if it's going to become a book or if it's just going to be published at Mary Farrell, but you are giving a presentation on this to Lancer in two parts, as Larry said. So there's one thing to look forward to for the November 19th through 21 conference this year online. But also to stay tuned, because guaranteed there'll be a lot more in the written work from Larry Hancock, who, you know, look, what can I say? If you don't know about Larry Hancock, then you don't know about my show. Welcome. And David Boylan, who is new to me, but apparently is also somebody to reckon with when it comes to assembling this stuff. And I think Larry has kind of hinted to me that David did most of the work here. But anyway, either way, really great stuff. And David, am I taking this in the wrong direction as far as what I see here from the writing as it's presented to me? And I can't wait to revisit this when it's out there formally somewhere for others to consume. But am I right? We can see a pattern here that suggests legend building, that suggests building the bona fides for well, one guy, but also a lot of other operations going on that all feed into this thing where you're still looking to try and figure out what the purpose is. But again, there's so many proximity violations here. It's impossible not to see connections. I don't know. Am I oversimplifying, David?
Not at all. Essentially, we want to have this published at the Mary Farrell Foundation. We got some pretty good editors looking at it now to help it. Mm-hmm. essentially, this is also a piece of work we would like other, you know, piece of research that we want others to build on also. This isn't just like the end all be all. This is like, this is what we have. Please, anybody add to this, build on, you know, a knowledge base here. Anybody got something they can add to this? This is great. This is where we're at now. But we continue to make revisions as we learn more and constantly learning more. But as far as legend building, yeah, it seems that way. And there's so many pieces and so many things we don't know that we're, you know, left to speculate and guess on certain things. And we're doing the best we can based upon the documents we have and what we know. But again, we're just constantly trying to learn more about this.
Mm. Well, you know, just like it seems very much in line with Larry Hancock's entire writing history, we have, look, this is as far as I could take it. By all means, use it as a foundation and move forward. Seems to be the attitude of every one of Larry Hancock's books. And his writing philosophy, maybe I'm being unfair or, you know, tell me I don't know what I'm talking about, Larry. But again, it seems to be a theme for you. Here is what I've been able to assemble so far. Please take it further because it can always be taken further. Never being the definitive, I have solved this, you know, but always filling in gaps and thoughtfully putting together context and, you know, showing the different sides of things, even if they don't necessarily entirely concur with maybe the original thesis. Things change as you write them, too. And that's what I appreciate about your writing style, and that's why I was very happy to do the Larry Hancock collection, which is also in the archives at Ocelli.com. But I'll be looking forward to seeing this at the Mary Farrell Foundation website. Larry, I'll leave you to put in the final word on this tonight, if that's okay. Unless David objects and would like to get in the final word afterwards because we missed something.
No, Larry, take it away, brother.
There you go.
Yeah, I think to sum it up, all of this evolved, as you pointed out before, something we knew from January for a long time. But it's been taken the new research, things that we've learned from the document. There's no way that Matthew Smith could have explored this scenario the way we can now. The information just was not available. The bits and pieces, the documents that David collected, were not available. This is a story that we really couldn't have told before the last couple of years, which is why something as seminal as the loose comment was ignored for so long. It's kind of like, oh, well, now in this context, that becomes very important. But to wrap it up, I guess what I'd like to say is that this scenario in this context makes a good deal of sense out of why a couple would show up with Lee Oswald at Red Bird Airport only days before the assassination. It makes perfect sense. And I like that part because it does reverse engineer January's remarks and even his impressions, his subjective impressions. The fascinating thing to me is that I can picture a scenario where all of this is, even the visit to Redbird, is part of an official, legitimate propaganda operation. Mm-hmm. Those people participating in it, you know, this is all part of our propaganda effort against Castro in Cuba. The people that are in Dallas from the DRE have been involved in propaganda for 2 years. Anita, Salvat, they've worked together. It could all be perfectly legitimate until they realize someone has hijacked it. Mm. And that it was put in place to control Oswald, to as a cover story, as a whatever. And then suddenly everybody realizes about within 24 hours that they've been had and they can't talk about it, and it automatically folds in on itself, which is just fascinating to me. So I can even picture all of this as part of a propaganda / counterintelligence operation that is literally hijacked in fairly the last minute, the last few weeks, to go along with the attack on the president and make sure that none of these people can ever talk. The only hole in the whole story is Lee Oswald being alive, and that was solved in a different fashion. Mm-hmm. But when I first examined the January leads, what, a decade ago, 2 decades ago, they look to me much like you described them, Chuck. It's kind of like it's interesting, but where could it possibly go? Now it could go a long way to explaining even what Lee Oswald did on November 22nd.
Well, and perhaps just like the Mrs. Luce testimony there, there could potentially be more things that have been overlooked up to this point. That exist in the documentation or that will emerge in documentation in the future that might answer some of these areas that we're required to speculate on because they're still as yet incomplete. But, this isn't just a couple of strokes of paint on the canvas now. Now we're starting to see, it's a nature scene. And there's some water there. I'm not sure which river they're painting, but that's water. That's the sky. And here we go. So I really appreciate you guys bringing this, onto my show for sure. I look forward to seeing where it goes in the very near future. Again, Larry Hancock, check out Larry's work. I recommend it all. Okay, so there you have it. Larry-Hancock.com. Look for his books on Amazon, whatever. David, is there a particular place that you would like people to check out anything you're doing, or are we going to have to wait for Mary Farrell to publish this? And I do mean the website. Of course, Mary Farrell is no longer among us, but the foundation is, and great people over there. And tell you this, if they find this relevant, I assure you, it has relevance. But are we going to have to wait for that, David, or is there somewhere else we can look for work you've done online somewhere?
Other than the Mary Farrell Foundation, co-wrote the Wheaton lead with Larry, so that's there.
I'll give a reference link to that. I totally forgot. That's true. The Wheaton lead, which, again, if you want to go deep, deep, deep into both of these leads, the Wheaton lead is helpful too. And there's other information that's helpful. A lot of this stuff, I mean, quite honestly, you guys had to point to the work of Mr. Smith. And, well, you know, it is where some of this stuff evolved. And we would have never gotten the post-mortem permission from Mr. January without his work, right? I mean, so here we are. There's a lot that can evolve if people put in the work, David. I'll put a link to that, which David co-wrote.
And the only other piece I wrote was many years ago, maybe 25 years ago, League of Their Own, Look Inside the Christian Defense League, and how it relates to the Kennedy assassination. Has to do with, like, Miltier and all his contacts. That you could probably find on the education forum under essays or seminars.
Excellent. Okay. So perhaps you can send me a link to that, David, so I can include it in the show notes because I'd like to give people points of reference. And again, like I said, I recommend anything Larry Hancock has put out. He has a blog, too. But, if you haven't read some of his books, then you probably don't know as much as you think you do about the assassination. But David, fascinating. I'm looking forward to it. And obviously you don't publish things just, to go for the, high volume output. And that's not an insult of any kind. That just shows me that you're thoughtful about what it is you decide to put out. And, obviously you couldn't have chosen a better, writing partner than Larry Hancock. Much like I envy Stu Wexler for having co-authored stuff with Larry. And who knows, maybe I'll talk to Stu sometime soon. I don't know, he's busy. But either way, look, a lot of great stuff here. Again, this is the second of the January leads. We don't have a third one. But who knows what might emerge in the future if people continue to do thoughtful research like Larry Hancock and David Boylan have. So anyway, the Ocelli Effect is all done for tonight. A little longer than the normal podcast, but I'm going to leave it in its extended form. No editing. We're just going to put it out. And I want to thank you guys for doing this with me. Thank you guys for listening. And no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, remember, I am merely Ocelli. All of you are indeed the effect. Good night.